This webcast was brought to you by the Library Science Program at the University of Missouri.
Dinosaurs. Jack silently thanked the Parodendron who had saved them from the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Thank him.
That's right. Annie put the dinosaur back with the other books. Then she gasped. Wow, she whispered, look at this. She held up a book about
dreams. Books are each a world, and books, we know, are a substantial world, both pure and good. That according to William Wordsworth. Logan Pearsall Smith had this to say on the topic. People say that life is the thing, but I prefer reading. I can agree with that. The Tiger Eye Reading Room is a dedicated space on the ground floor of Townsend Hall on the University of Missouri campus. In the reading room, youth services librarians in training and early childhood educators create story times for preschoolers enrolled in the Child Development Lab program. It's a magical experience that does not translate into statistics or outcome measures or any other quantifiable evaluation system, but it is a microcosm of and almost complete justification for the entire cycle of authorship, publishing, reading, and librarianship. The Tiger Eye Reading Room series of interviews and discussions brings together all aspects of this cycle. We will be talking to authors, readers, booksellers, children, reading adults, and the occasional librarian or two. We'll try and look at all aspects of the world of books and see what connections can be made or different viewpoints expressed. This interview was originally done at the annual conference of the American Library Association in New Orleans, June of 2006. Like any convention, there are lots of people about, so there's a fair amount of ambient noise in the background. Only once did it get bad enough that I had to pause the recording before we could progress. ALA annuals are huge, cumbersome, usually in hot places, but also serve as a wonderful chance to talk to authors, publishers, and the folks who attend the meetings. The New Orleans meeting was no exception, and we got some excellent interviews out of the trip. So here we are in the giant scrum that is the ALA Exhibit Hall, New Orleans 2006, and part of our continuing series of books, authors, readers, and the whole soup to nuts of that particular end of our business. And I'm here with O.R. Melling, a nice Irish lady lost in America. She's promoting a book, and we're going to talk about that and a few other things. But I have to know about this O.R. business. Just why are you or not?
Well, my editor calls me O.R., which, of course, would mean I'm gold, if you go with the French word. But O.R., just first two initials of my name, Orla. So okay. Orla is a fairly common Irish name, but I certainly haven't met anyone in America with it. And you could spell it O-R-L-A, or as in the Irish way, you can. There's at least five spellings of everything, but you can spell it O-R-L-A-I-T-H or O-R-L-A-G-H.
So lots of variations. What's it come out in Gaelic or Irish? Do you know that? Or
well, that would be an old Irish name, but it wouldn't. As far as I know, it doesn't have any. It doesn't mean anything in English.
Yeah, I was reading the other day about a Renaissance in teaching Irish or Gaelic, so which is a non sequitur as far as we're going here. Yeah. So your overall series is titled The Chronicles of Faerie. And anything that's Chronicles of course, C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia and other things pop to mind. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Although I do want to say something about the O.R.
Yep, go right ahead.
Another thing is that one of the reasons I decided to use initials is because I see myself in a long tradition of fantasy literature. All my favorite writers when I was a kid had initials. So C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, J.M. Barrie, P.L. Travers, who wrote the whole Mary Poppins series. And then when I was a kid, I read that C.S. Lewis's favorite writer was E. Nesbitt, so I read all her books. So I used the initials in that sense to put myself firmly in that tradition of all the fantasy literature that I love. So that's why the initials are there. And The Chronicles of Faerie is also then an homage to C.S. Lewis, the Narnian Chronicles. I read them when I was nine. But it also harkens to Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles, which I loved and I think was so beautifully written, that very lyrical. I love lyrical writing, and so his writing always appealed to me. And in fact, I pinched a little thing from his Martian Chronicles in my third book, The Lightbearer's Daughter, that will be out next year, 2007. One of my creatures, the boggles, who are little creatures that live in the bog, live in holes in the bog, their eyes are like copper coins during the day, but at night when the moon comes out, their eyes are like gold coins. And of course, I pinched that from Ray Bradbury's Martian.
Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, because I always loved that image, even when I was young, of the gold, their eyes were like gold coins.
Well, Ray Bradbury was a master of creating wonderful imagery. I, you know, like you, I read a lot of Ray Bradbury when I was young. As I mentioned earlier, I use Fahrenheit 451 as a text in one of my classes every now and then. So who are you? Who do you read now? I mean, is it just pretty much fantasy authors, or you wander afield and?
Well, the truth is, I don't read that much fantasy at all, actually. So I would have read mostly fantasy when I was younger. The main fantasy writer I read now is Charles Collins. He's a Canadian fantasist, and I just love. I love his work, and I have seven sisters as well as two brothers, and one of my sisters introduced me to Charles's work, and she said, I think he's stolen some of us and put us in his book. So a lot. I mean, I have five artist sisters out of that seven. They're painters and one's poet. So even the kind of women, the young women that he writes about, are like us when we were younger, and so I love him. And there's actually some American fantasy writers that I intend to read, that I want to read, and have been had them on this list for years, but couldn't find them in Ireland. So that's Terry Windling, and Ellen Kushner, and Delia Sherman, and who else? There are more in there. Maori. What's her name? Majori Snyder. Does that sound
yeah,
right? Something like that. There's a whole list of them.
Right,
yeah,
right,
that
right.
I just write. What I call mythic fiction, and they're like Charles Flint calls it mythic fiction. So and fairy tale, rewoven fairy tale. So I actually that's a list I have of people I want to read. I'm going to nick around to their publishers and see if there are any copies of their book to buy on the cheap. I don't care about. But but I read a lot of nonfiction and poetry. I love poetry, and so a lot of my favorite poets, like my American poets that I love, are Wallace Stevens and Emily Dickinson and Elizabeth Bishop. Is she American or is she British? Ooh, I'm really bad that way. And there's another woman, Amy. What's her last name? She's so brilliant. I just discovered her recently. And then Rilke, the German poet, and of course W.B. Yeats. I love it. And Patrick Kavanagh. So there's poets that I love, and I will often pinch phrases from poetry that I love, or rework poetical phrases into my work. I'd be inspired by poetical images. And then Jungian psychology, I love reading. Dr. James Hollis would be my favorite sort of Jungian, besides Jung. And I love reading the new physics. So quantum physics and, I mean, things like string theory and all that just blow my mind.
This is a long way from fantasy.
No, it's not. It's exactly right in there with fantasy. I mean, the notion that the foundation of reality are threads of potentiality.
Yeah,
I mean, what
yeah.
I would call silver threads. That's totally fantasy. Most fantasy readers or writers love science. It's like your opposite. You love your opposite. But if you go far enough in science, you come out the other end, and you're definitely in fantasy land. And same with the new cosmology. I love reading stuff like that. So,
Some years back, there was a U.S. TV show, Northern Lights. I don't know if you ever saw it or not, but one of the episodes, a circus came to town. And there was a circus clown who turned out had been a theoretical physicist who quit theoretical physics because particles at some minute some atomic level weren't behaving the way science said they should. And he decided if that was true, then there were fantasies and in the show, it became apparent this guy might just be able to fly, although they never actually showed it or not. So, yeah, I see.
That northern exposure.
Northern exposure, yeah, not northern
for
ice.
For a long time was Canadian, but...
No, it was shot, I think it probably shot in Canada, but a lot of our U.S. TV shows are. But
it was fabulous, I love that.
Yeah, good stuff. Charles DeLynch started out, in a lot of ways, sort of recasting traditional fairy stories, but then very clearly branched off on his own in this urban fairy or urban myth kind of thing that he's been working for a number of years. Do you see a lot of other fantasy authors sort of following that trail, or is there way too much rewriting of Tolkien going on?
No, that's hard to say. Because one thing you don't like to do as a writer is, you know, what's the word, diss other writers.
Yes, well.
Because for one thing, you know how hard it is for them to work.
We don't have to name names here.
Because a lot of fantasy, I think, is rubbish, actually. I think there's a huge amount of rubbish being written at the moment. And that's because there's a lot of bandwagon jumpers in terms of just people who are throwing out fantasy because that's what's selling, and so there's a lot of bad stuff, but that is what happens when a genre becomes mainstream and you actually have to sort the wheat from the chaff. And yeah, I think there's a lot of Tolkien copiers. All right, it's the other, I suppose, for me there's, you see, there are two different types of fantasies. The real clear dividing line are those who entirely invent new worlds that are a new world all on its own, and that would be the Tolkien branch. That's where you, well, in Narnia, Middle Earth, whatever. But then the Charles DeLint side, and the side I would be on, which is you're actually using this world and you're creating magic out of this world, or magic is coming into this world. So that, and the urban fantasy, of course, brings magic to the cities, whereas everybody always believed magic was in the country. Now I'm in the Chronicles of Fairy. I'm reworking fairy myth and fairy folklore, but also inventing my own and creating my own version of fairies. So my fairies are like million-year-old teenagers, basically. They're gorgeous.
Fairy fire.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They love to party. They're very alluring, but they also get bored. You know, especially if they're hanging around for so long. So that's one of the reasons they interact with humanity, is for their own entertainment, and that's what also makes them dangerous. You know. Because they don't have the same set of principles as us. They'd be fairly amoral. But I suppose somebody, I can't remember who, some reviewer said I did for fairies what Anne Rice did for vampires. But
I think your writing
at a young adult level.
I think your writing is considerably more graceful than the other person we just mentioned.
Well,
that's
another Chronicle series. They were the Vampire Chronicles. Well, to be honest, I like her Vampire Chronicles. I did like them.
Do you?
I read the interview.
I started on Lestat, and
I stopped at Queen of the Damned.
I stopped halfway through
Lestat.
I just thought, no, this is way too.
It's getting too over the top.
She
is kind of a goth herself.
Well,
So I think
she lived here in New Orleans for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. I understand she's moved.
That makes sense, of course, because New Orleans is the major setting for the set.
And she made awfully good use, I thought, of the setting.
Yeah.
Somebody was telling me yesterday she's moved on to other places.
Moved into very strange places.
Well, here, let's not go down this road anymore yet. When you're writing, you're writing young adult novels, which is a tough area because who knows what's going on kids' heads. How much thought do you put in? How much thinking do you have to do in that part of the creative process, saying, I'm writing for kids here?
I hardly do that at all.
Yeah,
I don't, to be honest, I don't even think about that. I think, well, C.S. Lewis talked about this two different, in his essay on children's writing, the different kinds of writers who write for children, and in this case we'll say children or young adults, but he said there are those there are those who write this genre because it most suits what they have to say. And in that sense, what I want to talk about, what I'm interested in, and it actually is what I call soul stories. I'm interested in writing stories that that feed the soul or nourish the soul. That would, you know, that side of us that wants to be fed. And I find that fantasy or mythic fiction serves that is as a good medium for me to tell, and that's where I tell the stories. Now the way they end up being for young adults, because the main characters are teenagers, and it's actually quite easy for me to write from that point of view, because I remember very well being a teenager. So aside from the fact that I now have a teenager who is my first reader, but I was writing these long before she was a teenager.
Yeah,
I was writing them when she was a baby. But now, as a teenager, and a really bright teenager, and I pay her because she's working, and teenagers always need money, because, you know, she takes time out to do it. She reads. She's my first reader. And her usual response from time to time may be, you know, Mom, no teenager would ever say that. Or, what is she wearing? That's her other main reaction. But story-wise, she doesn't have any problems with them. But I'd say I have firmly in my mind the 18-year-old I was, who hitchhiked across Canada and down through California and lived on Highway 1 for 3 months. She was such a turning point in my own life and who I was going out into the world, that she's quite clearly still in my head. And so I can write from her point of view very easily. I think teenagers know if you're deliberately trying to write to them, and they hate that. You know, they really hate that. It's more if you write from your own teenager, and even if you write from your own point of view. Because every once in a while, I know I've read some reviews on Amazon.com, and one teenager said, she goes, well, sometimes the writing gets pokey, but it's okay. The story's good enough, it'll get you past it.
Probably a genuinely honest review.
But see, I think if you're trying to write specifically to teenagers, I mean, sometimes you can see that even in TV programs, and they actually don't like it. You know, they can spot that.
Well, yeah, nobody likes to be condescended to.
And
I suspect that kids are very good at seeing, picking up on the BS factor.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
I won't say the whole
thing,
but
radar
is very good.
And I find because I actually really like teenagers, and I think this is another thing they can pick up really easily, and it's something you can't hide if you're speaking to groups. So I say I'm just at the end of my 3-week tour. I would be in schools, libraries, and bookstores talking to teenagers, and I just really like them, and they know that. They know when their teachers like them, they know the adults like them or not, and they respond to that. And no matter how indifferent they appear to be, they actually do care whether or not their teachers like them, and whether or not the adults around them like them. It's important to them.
One hopes. I got to admit that
I think it is important to them.
Awfully happy when my kids grew up and I could have a semi-adult conversation with them.
Well, did you ever hear Billy Connolly talking about his kids? he goes, my kids hate me, but I just give them money all the time. You know, I just pay them, then they like me.
I can only imagine Billy Connolly on
father,
the top as a father.
As
yeah,
a father.
Yeah, yeah. The guy is multifaceted. I'm thinking about Mrs. Brown right now.
Oh,
he's
a brilliant actor.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
he's so
funny. Yeah.
I love him.
You've talked a little bit about C.S. Lewis and writing for the soul and things like that, and we chatted about this earlier. And do you get any of the reaction that J.K. Rowling gets over the Harry Potter factor from very conservative Christians who see it as essentially an anti-Christian statement, or at least that particular series, because it's not real or something, to which my reaction is, folks, it's a novel. No novel is real.
No, actually, although I think the thing that the main problem the fundamentalist Christians have with Harry Potter is the witch thing. And this just goes back to that Bible statement, suffer a witch not to live.
Yeah.
You see, that is where literalism about the Bible can trigger off that kind of reaction. I actually really think that that is, whereas they accept C.S. Lewis because the witch gets killed at the end. It's the idea of good witches that, you know, that just, to them, can, and it's the occult, you see, that is, fundamentalist Christians have a real, they fear the occult, and they have a real thing against the occult, and that is actually, I think, at the core of the Harry Potter, although I have my another theory about the, why both the Roman Catholic Church, because the Pope has made a statement against Harry Potter, even though he hasn't read it. Oh, yeah, he made a statement against it. This
oh, heaven forfend, we should read
yeah.
that. Which
no, it's in fact, you cannot buy a copy of Harry Potter in Vatican City, because it has been banned from there. That, so I read this on a European newspaper, because a German writer wrote a book against Harry Potter, again, from the fundamentalist Christian point of view, so the Pope went on online with that, or... In tune with that, but my own theory about why the Roman Catholic Church, or the right wing of it, and the fundamentalist Christians would be against it is because it's a secular fantasy. There is no God in the Harry Potter world, and it's one of the few fantasies, if the only fantasy, that has a secular world. I think this is one of the reasons, for instance, that secular nations like China are able to read it. There's no God. Harry is alone in the universe. Dealing with evil. He has no God to call on, no religion.
I think there's no explicit God in Harry Potter. I'm not sure what there is.
Dumbledore refers to the power of love. It's kind of an
implicit. Yeah, I think there's an implicit power in there. I don't know, maybe
it's just
my reading.
The power of love. That remember his mother saved him through her love for him. That's all. There is
But where was she drawing on, though? See,
she never even goes there, though. She doesn't go there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, she doesn't. I'll agree.
It's
but
very secular. Because
I would
Voldemort,
read it as implicit.
Voldemort's evil comes from the mistreatment from his childhood, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Harry's goodness comes from his parents' love. It's very secular. There's no...
Harry got mistreated a lot as a kid. He was living in this closet.
Yeah, but his mother loved him, and then Dumbledore loved him, so that's all. He had love for him.
Yeah, but how old... Well, we could go on and on about this, Ralph.
I know.
Okay,
I'm a big Harry Potter fan.
Let's talk about Charles Dullent, then. I don't think there's any explicit...
God or religion
God or religion in there. Now, clearly, there's a lot of... What I think is quasi-religious or non-Christian religion. You know,
mystical,
he draws heavily
on
the Native American traditions.
Yeah.
But I don't see much of any overt Christianity in there.
He would have. No, I don't think he has Christianity in there at all. I think he's got it's mystical and mythic. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I'll have to think about that now before I make a comment on it.
Okay.
But anyway,
I love catching people.
I am stumped. I'm stumped. Anyway, as for me, I suppose I haven't had any difficulty because I actually occasionally have quotes from the Bible running through my book, and mainly because the Bible is such a beautifully written book from so many different sources. But I also have actually quotes from the Quran and from Hindu sacred texts and from Buddhist texts as well. Because sacred texts are so poetical, so beautifully written. And it's like a writer friend of mine said about a lot of the New Age stuff. I mean, I will read New Age stuff, but a lot of the stuff that's supposed to be inspired or channeled from the gods, he says, if it comes from the gods, why is it so badly written? You know?
Exactly.
And that's
exactly.
Where you can tell that sacred texts were inspired by some other source or some true source, because they are beautifully written. You know, apparently the Quran is supposed to be so exquisitely written in the Arabic that it actually makes Arab speakers weep at the beauty of the language of it. You know, so that's how they know it did come through the angel Gabriel from God. But... So no, I haven't had. And in fact, I get emails from Christians asking me, am I Christian? Because, of course, they
pick up on the book.
I'd have quotes from, especially the Song of Solomon, which I think is beautiful. So at one point when I'm describing fairy, it's actually quotes from, you know, things like the Garden of Frankincense and Myrrh, and these are the Well of Living Waters. They're quotes from that song, because it's so beautiful. So I wouldn't have a problem there. And then you see, because I suppose I do have a witch. Granny Hart is a witch, but then the witch word in Irish, Cailleach, is the word for witch, but it also means wise woman or old woman. So it actually means the same thing. I don't have a lot of occult, though, and I think that's why, as I said, that's sometimes the thing that triggers off fundamentalist Christians are occult guys. So mine's fairy folklore.
Well, I think Ireland, of course, has got a huge, rich tradition of that literature, and I wouldn't imagine anybody in Ireland's got any problems with it.
Well, do you know Ireland never, there were only ever three, even during the witch burning time, when all of Europe was just burning women to death and calling them witches, Ireland only had three witches executed, and they were all Protestants. It was the Protestant community of Ireland that killed the three witches. But even two of them were murderesses. Do you know what I mean?
They probably got executed, one had killed
about five husbands or something.
Yeah.
So it's a question of whether they were even executed for being a witch or the other. But so there is, the Roman Catholicism of Ireland has always been very tolerant of pagan belief, simply because it absorbs paganism rather than fight against it. Like, say, when the Christian church came into England, the Druids were slaughtered on the Isle of Mona. In Ireland, not a single Druid was slaughtered. They just all went wholesale into the monasteries. You know, they just went, fine, this is a new religion.
Okay.
And that's why we have our body of ancient myths. Because the Druids, who became monks, wrote down all our old stories. They saved their own material.
You must have read that book, How the Irish Saved Civilization.
No, I think it's
about the Irish Renaissance of 7th, 8th century.
Well, I know we did because
like
I studied it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful book. You should read that. We're talking about children here, and there's a lot of sort of angst out there in library land that says... kids are all hung up on video games and tiny little sound bites, and they haven't got the patience to read actual books anymore. One of the saddest things I ever heard was some years back, somebody told me that The Wind in the Willows had fallen out of favor with kids because there were too many words involved. Have you got any sense for that at all, out of younger people or the kiddos you're writing for?
Well, now I have to say, and this is absolutely true, that fantasy readers read higher than their age group and also tend to love words. So it's actually not a problem in the fantasy area specifically.
Yeah.
In fact, they would love even invented words, and but they do. And it's not just me as a fantasy writer saying that, but I would, for instance, say my work is for 12 to 16 is my core group, and then even older, 19 and early 20s. But I have actually been contacted by 10 and 11-year-old readers, which always surprises me, and even the odd 9-year-old. I wouldn't even think for a minute of recommending my work for those age groups, but when they are fantasy readers, they read really high. These kids are reading The Lord of the Rings, which I didn't read till I was 12.
Yeah.
They're reading it at 9
yeah.
and 10. So, I know that it's almost like it counters what they're saying is the trend in other areas, that kids aren't reading and they're not reading. I mean, fantasy readers read huge books, you know, the fatter the better, and series, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And even, say, a series like Darren Chan, which I have to say I cannot read, but he can weep all the way to the bank for me saying that, you know. But he is so popular with boys who don't like to read at all. If you have a young boy who doesn't read, they read the first Darren Chan and they read them all, and they're dying for the next one. So again, it's almost like the fantasy genre encourages read. And then with Rowling herself, I mean, let's face it, she has increased child literacy on the planet.
I was going to say that it's almost a truism that kids that won't read will be out there at midnight waiting for the next Harry Potter to show
and
up.
And people who say that they don't read them, this is nonsense. They do read them. And, I mean, she is constantly inundated with letters from kids who have read her books.
Yeah.
And I've met all the kids who have read her books. And my daughter, as soon as the book comes out, disappears for 3 days, comes out to eat, you know.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
I hear these other fantasy writers saying, but they don't actually read the book. That's nonsense.
Yeah.
But, you know, thanks to her, kids are reading books. I mean, if you think about the 21st century, children lining up not to get a video game or some new electronic toy, a book, and a big fat book, and a well-written,
fat book,
you know? So, I think she's brilliant. I didn't read her for ages. I was so jealous. I just finally read her. And, okay, this is what the fuss is all about. You know, I'm supposed to be a lovely woman. So.
Well, that's what I've always understood. Maybe she'll wander into one of
everyone
these.
Everyone who's met her says she's lovely.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground here in 28 minutes and something, and I think I'm going to ask you if there are any final thoughts on books, reading, authors, the publishing industry. Probably you don't want to diss your publisher.
No, actually, I'm really happy with my American publishers. They've just toured me all around America. I mean, I thought, this is a job? Yeah, no, because I went from, landed in New York for 3 days, then I was in Atlanta for a fabulous Mythic Journeys conference that Deepak Chopra was headlining, and then I went from there to Baltimore, Washington, D.C., where I got to see the White House, and where was it? Fredericksburg, Virginia, Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco, L.A., San Bernardino, and here in New Orleans.
Cool.
I would never complain about a publisher who's just...
Beats hitchhiking down the Pacific Coast Highway, doesn't it?
Yeah, I even thought that at one point. I'm in a really nice hotel, swimming pool. I'm being picked up by limos. And I was thinking, this is a far cry from the 18-year-old inner bare feet thumbing around California with not a penny in her pocket.
Not a penny. Well, O.R. Melling, this has been a genuine pleasure, and when we're going to go on the air, I'll make sure you find out about this.
Oh, thanks.
And I want to thank you for sitting and talking with us for the last hour, only half of which we actually recorded, but it's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
So ends another session in the Tiger Eye Reading Room. Come back again for more interesting and, we hope, provocative discussions from the world of books. Reading, writing, publishing, promoting, care and feeding in a library. You know where the schedule is posted. See you next time on LIS Radio. This webcast is brought to you by the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri and made possible by a gift from the Verizon Foundation. Is your library making a difference in the lives of people it's dedicated to serving? If it is, then someone in that organization might win a graduate scholarship from the University of Missouri Columbia. The Make a Difference Library Challenge is sponsored by the MU Graduate School and the MU School of Information Science and Learning Technologies. We challenge your library to make a difference in the quality of your constituents' lives through innovative programs that employ information-rich and technology-intensive strategies to meet their needs. For more information about the Make a Difference program, check out our website, makeadifference.missouri.edu. That's make-a-difference.missouri.edu.